When I found out that Carlos Fuentes had passed away last month, I headed straight for my closet to dig through a cluttered box that I had been meaning to organize for years. After much feverish excavation, I finally found what I was looking for, an old cassette tape with a handwritten label, Interview with Carlos Fuentes in the Car. Carlos Fuentes, son of a Mexican diplomat, born in 1928 in Panama and raised in Washington, D.C., had a very unique upbringing, though he always identified himself as a Mexican writer. This unique perspective, as both an insider and outsider within diverse cultures, is reflected in his work and reveals a complex understanding of the clashes of Mexican history and modern-day life. His novels interweave mythological events with real stories of corruption, greed, love, fear, and crises of identity. In the tumultuous 1960s and 70s, these crises of identity were shared amongst numerous Latin American writers, and Fuentes, along with Mario Vargas Llosa and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, helped spark a momentous literary movement that caught on so quickly it became known as El Boom. Since news hit on May 15th that Carlos Fuentes had passed away at the age of 83, there's been a global outpouring of grief for the loss of a man known as a great thinker and writer. President of Mexico, Felipe Calderón, announced, "I deeply lament the death of our beloved and admired Carlos Fuentes, a universal Mexican writer." The New York Times referred to him as one of the most admired writers in the Spanish-speaking world. When I interviewed Fuentes in 2006, he was already a legend in the literary world. I was then a graduate student in Dartmouth College's comparative literature program and had spearheaded an effort to bring Fuentes to campus as a guest speaker. The occasion was a sad one. It was during Dartmouth's annual commemoration of Suzanne Zantop, a beloved professor who'd been shockingly murdered in her home in 2001. Fuentes had known her when he taught at Dartmouth as a visiting professor years earlier. As I stood in the lobby, waiting anxiously for Fuentes to appear, my heart raced every time the elevator doors opened. My apprehensions quickly disappeared when Fuentes emerged from the elevator with a radiant smile, and he and his wife Sylvia embraced me as though we'd known each other for years. Fuentes was impeccably dressed in a tailored gray suit and tie with his trademark mustache. He boyishly cracked jokes, and as we continued our walk across campus, he and Sylvia reminisced about their time at Dartmouth, recounting vivid memories spent with their children playing in the vast lawns surrounding the beautiful campus. The following day, I accompanied them on a road trip to Providence, Rhode Island, for another engagement at Brown University. This interview was totally unplanned. I only knew that having 3 hours with Carlos Fuentes in the car was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and what was caught on tape shows Fuentes in a remarkably candid moment. In his book, This I Believe, Fuentes says about death, "We live in an age that is ours, but we are also the ghosts of an older age, as well as the foreshadowing of an age that is yet to come. Let us not lose sight of these promises that death holds." Our conversation about the role of art in politics, literature in exile, his identity as a Mexican writer, and his own influences foreshadowed the very things that he would be remembered for long after his death. Lily Canso for Guernica.
For coming to Dartmouth yesterday and having a wonderful lecture and for allowing me to interview you. So the first question that I have for you, I thought of when we were inviting you and considering that you've been so influential as a novelist, as a writer, and considering the relationship in America between their artists, writers, painters, poets, and the public. So it's not possible here for an American writer to be considered for public office or to be consulted for public office. And I wonder why, or you think that that would change anything if it were the case. For example, in Latin America, I don't think it would be unusual for a poet or a writer to be appointed in the cabinet, minister of education or culture. So do you think it would make a difference if that happened here? Or could you tell me what you think the differences are between Latin America?
Well, anything would be better in the United States than what you have as a government and as cabinet. It's really very low quality, given the fact that this country produces eminent intellectuals, has great universities, and then the people who arrive in government are very mediocre. Latin American situation has been very different. In the first place, because writers have spoken for those who have no voice. The weight of illiteracy, poverty, joblessness in Latin America has been so great throughout our history that if the writers didn't speak out for the people, nobody would. The governments were corrupt, etc. Things have changed now. We mostly have democratic governments in Latin America, so the position of the writer has changed. It is not, as Neruda used to say, Pablo Neruda, a Latin American writer walks around with the body of his people on his back. Now we have citizens, we have public means of expression, political parties, Congress, unions. So the writer's position has changed. We now consider ourselves to be citizens, not spokespeople for everybody, but citizens that participate in the political and social process of the country. You also speak of the question of holding posts, which used to be a distinguished position writers had. Most writers in Mexico have had posts as ambassadors, secretaries. That is no longer the case. It is no longer the case because now a writer can live off writing. He has an audience, their publishing houses, their newspapers, so the situation is not as terrible as it used to be when there were no means, no outlets for the writer to make money, and he had to go into government service, be an ambassador or a cabinet minister, etc. So things are changing in the sense that the civil society is now the protagonist in Latin America, along with the institutions of the civil society, political parties, unions, parliament, and the writer therefore occupies a different position, but no less influential than in the past in a new democratic society.
Thank you. Okay, so my next question actually is more for me, related to the thesis that I'm working on right now on Juan Goytisolo and Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish. So in doing research, I came across two articles published in the same year, 1984. One by Edward Said, called The Mind of Winter, Reflections on Life in Exile, and one by you, called Juan Goytisolo, or The Novel in Exile. And in Said's article, he says, well, you could say that most of the modern canon of Western literature is written by writers in exile, but it has become a motif in modern culture rather than recognized as a real sense of homelessness, of suffering. And in your article, you talk about Goytisolo and his status as exile. Now, he was forced to sort of swallow the language of his oppressors and spit it back out and use it. I wonder how, in a time that we live in where identity is so fluid and everybody seems to be from somewhere, and now that, and plus your position, how do you position yourself? Do you consider yourself a writer in exile? How would you comment on the relationship?
I've never considered myself a writer in exile because I grew up outside my own country, because my father was a diplomat. Therefore, I grew up in Brazil, in Chile, Argentina, the United States. I studied in Switzerland. So I've always had a relation of perspective with my country. I'm thankful for that. I mean, there are really two types of writer. Our greatest novelist ever, Juan Rulfo, the author of Pedro Páramo, never left Jalisco and the states of Mexico where he sold tires and drove around and heard stories. He's the great example of a writer very much bred, rooted in the country, that transforms all he has heard into great art. My position was very different because I had a perspective on Mexico since I was a child. I was a boy of 10 when President Cárdenas expropriated the oil holdings of foreign companies, and there was a wave of anti-Mexicanism in the United States. There were big headlines, Mexican communists steal our oil. Then I lost friends at school. I was in grade school. I was looked upon with suspicion. So I was always meant to feel that I was a Mexican. And I was the son of a diplomat. I heard the news from Mexico. I sided with Mexican causes. So I grew up in a kind of exile until I was 15 years old. always outside of Mexico, but always very conscious that I was a Mexican. So that gave me a consciousness of being Mexican, different from someone who had never left Mexico. So it works both ways. Yeah. There, for a moment there, I could have become an Argentinian or a Chilean. It was very bounded to my friends, my schools in Santiago and Buenos Aires. But no, Mexico always won me over. And you know why? Because Mexico always was and always will be a mystery for me. A big question mark. What is this country all about? How can I understand it? You know, when García Márquez doesn't understand the Baroque political situation in Mexico, he goes to the National Museum of Anthropology and stands before the Coatlicue, the mother goddess of the Aztecs, a gigantic sculpture, a block of serpents, headless, tremendous, of a goddess saying, I am a goddess, not a person. Don't try to find personality in me. I'm not Venus. I'm Coatlicue, the goddess of serpents. And when he has stood 5 minutes in front of Coatlicue, he says, now I understand Mexico, and leaves. So it's a very complex, mysterious country, and I will never understand it fully, and that's why I write so much about it, yeah, in order to try to understand it.
Do you have any comment on Juan Goytisolo in particular?
I have a lot of comments on Juan Goytisolo. I think, frankly, directly, that he is the greatest living Spanish author from Spain. But I've always refused to call Goytisolo merely a Spanish author, an author from Spain. I consider him part of the Hispano-American literature. For a long time, Goytisolo was not published in Spain. Franco's censorship would not have him. So he was published in Mexico. He was published in Buenos Aires. He is really the typical example of the unity of the Spanish language. The fact that we are 500 million people who think and speak in the Spanish language. So I consider Goytisolo a Spanish-American writer, along with García Márquez or Cortázar or myself. And certainly, from any measure, a worldwide writer, a universal writer of the highest caliber, a man capable of extraordinary experiments. He takes fantastic risks. He's never content with what he does, which is always the sign of a good writer. Once you're contented with what you do and feel comfortable in your writing, I think something is wrong with you. You have to be very angry, very discontented, and always looking for different things. And I think he's the prototype. More than me, more than any one of us, Goytisolo is the great experimental, daring, risk-taking author of the Spanish language.
Do you still spend time regularly with people like Goytisolo or other writers on a regular basis?
Yes, my wife Sylvia and I spent, about a week with him in Marrakesh.
Oh, we spent a week.
We spent a week in Marrakesh with him, going around the city. He knows the city in such a way that if you're not guided by Goytisolo, you will be lost forever. You will never be heard of from again. So we receive it in Mexico, we meet in Spain, in Paris, in Marrakesh. It's a very, very strong friendship we have. I'm very grateful for that friendship.
I'm wondering now if we could move and you would comment a little bit. For the first time, America is seeing hundreds and thousands of protests, yeah, for this immigration. And, you know, it's a tricky issue because all nationalities deserve these rights. But if the United States were just to give workers rights to work here, wouldn't that be tantamount to slavery? I mean, how do you see what is happening now in America?
What is happening is a double-edged sword. There is a U.S. responsibility. The United States needs these workers. I mean, the United States would not eat. Yeah. It wouldn't have breakfast without Mexican workers. They pick up the oranges, the tomatoes, they do the work nobody else wants to do. Somebody wants to do it. I hope that someday Mexico will give full employment to our workers. Then the United States will have to work, will look for these workers another place. In Papua, New Guinea, the North Pole, I don't know where. But it will need these people to do the work nobody else will do in a post-industrial society that does not want, in some instances, to recognize itself as such. The United States still thinks that it is a 19th century industrial society. It isn't that any longer. It has to adapt to a new reality. But we have a grave responsibility in Mexico, which is to give work to our own people.
Yeah.
A As long as we have a system that denies work to 50% of the population, you'll have immigrants coming to the United States. When we have a better, more social, more responsible, less egotistical, less corrupt system, we'll be able to give work to the millions of Mexicans who have to build our roads, our dams, our sewers, our schools, all the things that are left undone in Mexico while we have the manpower. I see trains loaded with Mexican workers going north. I say, why are not they doing the work that is needed in Oaxaca, yeah, in Tabasco, in Chiapas, in Yucatan, everywhere? Why? There is something very bad going on both sides of the border. But the worker is a worker. He's not a criminal. He or she are not criminals. The Sensenbrenner Act is a monstrosity. It's a monstrosity that criminalizes the fact that people need work and that this country needs the work. So I'm in favor of a solution such as the Kennedy-McCain proposals that make it clear what steps have to be taken to accept the fact that the United States needs foreign workers. I'm not specifying Mexican workers, but foreign workers to do the work that nobody else wants to do. There has to be some legal solution, some peaceful solution, which is not the criminalizing of the worker as the horrendous Sensenbrenner bill asks for.
But you use the word criminalizing. Do you think that right now this is promoting a climate of fear among the Latin community? I mean, post 9/11, with the sense of racially profiling and all these other things, is there a climate of fear forming in which people would be afraid that their husband or wife or son or something could be taken away from them, or could?
Well, what I see is the contrary of fear. I see extreme courage. When I see millions of people in the street of Los Angeles, of Seattle, of Omaha, of all places, what I'm seeing is an act of courage, not an act of fear. Some of them, I read today, have been penalized for taking part in the marches. They've been thrown out of their jobs. They will come back, or somebody else will come, because the work has to be done. It's as simple as that. But I think there is no fear. There is courage. On the contrary, before there used to be fear. This is comparable to the Chavez, Cesar Chavez's movement, when all these workers came out of the shadows into the streets. Now the immigrants are also coming into the streets. And the worst that could happen is the apocalyptic day without Mexicans, in which this country would come to a standstill. It would then ask for Mexican workers to come back as soon as possible, because this country would not feed itself, it would not educate itself, it would not transport itself without the Mexican worker.
It would never happen, but there is a sense of what kind of class are they asking for? Because there are countries where they still give their immigrants no rights whatsoever. And I mean, could a democracy like America take part in this kind of treating people like slaves, essentially?
Like criminals, first of all. Like criminals, or also like slaves. If the employers are taskmasters. But I feel there's, thanks to these manifestations we have seen lately, there's a great sense of the community between migrant workers, which is the forecast of what I believe in, which is that this, which is not a problem, it is an opportunity. Migration is an opportunity, not a problem. And in the sense that it is an opportunity, it starts with a unilateral law from this country, the Kennedy-McCain Act, let's say. It goes on to a bilateral agreement between Mexico and the United States, the United States and El Salvador, the United States and the Dominican Republic, whatever you wish. And finally, it has to be a multilateral international event. I'm in favor of an international union of migrant workers that really takes in the problems that affect Europe with the migrants coming from Africa and the Arab countries, and the United States with the migrants coming from Mexico and Latin America. It has to be considered an international question with international solutions and with no problems, national or international. Migration is not a problem, it is an opportunity.
I have a couple more. So this year saw several major elections in Latin America with a remarkable shift to the left. So, and America has tried to intervene and has even been antagonistic towards some of the leaders in Latin America. And I wonder, is there just a shift to the left, or is this a response to America sort of trying to take over everywhere?
No, the United States has nothing to do with the shift, nothing whatsoever. This is something that has happened because the military dictatorships of the Cold War that existed with United States backing, because it sufficed for Pinochet or the Argentinian junta to say we are anti-communist, and they received the backing of the United States immediately. When the Cold War was over, the dictatorships had no further raison d'être. So we had democracy, democratic forces came forth, and we had elections, democratic parliaments, a free press, a series of important democratic conquests, all the way from Mexico to Chile, Brazil, Argentina. Now there is a second stage in which people are saying these democratic freedoms are okay, they're great, we want to preserve them, but when do we get to work? When do we get to eat? When are we going to be educated? When are we going to have opportunities? So it is now the masses of Latin America that are electing governments they feel can take forward the democratic reforms of the past 20 years and transform them into social and economic reforms. This is, I think, extremely important because it also means that the left has abandoned the revolutionary solution proposed by Che Guevara in his time and has taken the democratic path. Every single left-wing president, even Hugo Chavez, whom I do not consider the left, I consider to be a right-wing fascist disguised as a leftist. That's another case. But everybody has come through elections. Evo Morales has been elected. Lula has been elected. Kirchner has been elected. Nobody has arrived at power through violent means. And this is a great game, to have the formal freedoms of democracy in place and now to demand the material, the concrete well-being that democracy is supposed to have as a base as well.
Thank you. So to move over, finally, do you think that since the war in Iraq, the United States said that they were looking for weapons of mass destruction. They weren't found, and so the administration switched their motive to promoting democracy. So this problem of America's promise to promote democracy has been, it's nothing new. And I'm just wondering, is that possible, that this will actually?
I am a Mexican. The United States lived 75 years with the one-party system in Mexico, the PRI, without batting an eyelid, never demanding democracy of Mexico. Democracy came because Mexicans fought for democracy and made a democracy out of our history, our possibilities, our perspectives. Democracy is not something that can be exported like Coca-Cola. It has to be bred from the inside according to the culture, the conditions of each country. There will be Arab democracies on Arab terms, according to Arab faith, Arab customs, Arab history, Arab antecedents. You cannot impose it. It is a self-fulfilling failure to try to impose democracy. Is Condoleezza Rice going to impose democracy on Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, or are the Egyptian people going to find a democratic way out for Egypt? Obviously, it's ridiculous to think that the United States can impose democracy. The United States lived with Somoza, Trujillo, Batista, Castillo Armas, the worst dictators we've had in Latin America, were all puppets of the United States. What democracy are we talking about? It'll come from us, not from them.
Thank you. And I just want to end with a couple of questions to you regarding academic life. Do you like it? Do you like teaching? How has your experience been at Brown, at Dartmouth, at Harvard?
Listen, I'm a writer, and as Sylvia knows, I spend all my day sitting before a notebook with a pen in hand, writing and writing and writing, and reading and reading and reading. This is my life. From time to time, I need a break. And giving lectures, traveling, going to the universities is a way of coming out of the solitude of writing, which I enjoy, I like, but I have to break it from time to time, And it is getting to know new people and young people without consequences. So it's not bad. It's simply my spring break, if you wish.
Who do you read? Like to read?
Oh no, I read so much, I would exhaust you if I told you, huh?
You read everything. And is there, you spend most of your time in Mexico or in London?
No, in London, and part of the year in Mexico, and part of the year traveling in Europe or in the United States. It's a diversified life. Yeah. As she knows, we have to pack bags all the time.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you. Thank you.
No, quiero decir también sobre Juan Goytisolo que es la liga más cierta que existe entre la literatura latinoamericana y el mundo árabe. El mundo de la literatura árabe, él ha sido el intermediario entre la cultura de lengua española y la cultura de lengua árabe. Después de todo, el 40% de las palabras que usamos en castellano son de origen árabe. Los árabes estuvieron 7 siglos en la península española, nos dieron lengua, nos dieron arquitectura, nos dieron música, nos dieron limpieza, porque los castellanos no se bañaban y los árabes sí. Hay agua en el mundo árabe, en Castilla no hay agua. Entonces tenemos una deuda inmensa con ellos, y Goytisolo es hoy el puente, el intermediario entre una cultura que tendemos a olvidar en América Latina y el mundo árabe.
Muchas gracias. Es lo que estoy estudiando de ahora, de Al-Ándalus, y cómo le representa en su obra. Muy interesante.
Yo le hice una entrevista para la televisión hace varios años, y de pronto se escuchó la voz de la mezquita, tú sabes, cada determinado, cuando es la llamada a rezar. Y empezó esta voz de alguien que era el que hacía el grito este, ¿no? Y entonces, ¿sabes? Él se cayó. Y duramos todo el tiempo de la entrevista, oye, escuchando este canto del hombre, este quejido que hace, ¿no?
Sí,
¿sabes?
Sí.
Y lo duramos todo el tiempo hasta que terminó. Y luego seguimos.
Y se grabó todo, ¿verdad?
Todo se grabó. Fue muy bonito porque hubo un silencio. Estaba inmóvil él e inmóvil yo porque era televisión, o sea que lo veíamos. Muy bien.